This is Scenic Roots talking writing. The annual Southern Festival of Books starts tomorrow. For more than 30 years, Humanities Tennessee, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, has been organizing a three-day celebration of writers and writing in Nashville. This year, for the first time, the festival, featuring over 100 writers, being interviewed, reading from their work, and participating in roundtable discussions, along with conversations with the audience, will be online every day for 11 days, starting tomorrow and continuing through October 11th. All the details on the festival are on their website, Southern Festival of Books 2020. Sharon Cameron is one of the authors who will be reading from her work and talking about it. In a note on her website, she wrote, "I don't want anyone or anything to ever be forgotten. I want to understand the past. I'm fascinated by history," she told me, and yet her most recent book, The Light in Hidden Places, is her first drawn directly from history. It's the true story of two sisters in a small town in Poland who hid 13 Jewish people in their tiny attic while the town was occupied by the Nazis in World War II. I talked to Sharon on the phone from her home in Nashville, but before we started talking, she read from the opening pages of her book.
Chapter 1. Siemisz, Poland, November 1942. Someone is out there, in the dark. I open my eyes, and the dark is the same as always, a blank page. I can smell the cabbage Emelika boiled two floors below us, feel the sigh beside me that is my sister's sleeping breath. But the dark has also changed. There's an echo inside it, a sound my ears have missed. Someone is here. Now I am awake. I fold back the blanket, quiet, listening, stretching my legs to the floor. A mattress spring pops like a gunshot. My sister breathes, but she doesn't stir. If someone is here, they are not in this room. I tiptoe barefoot across the boards and put a finger to the edge of the rug I've nailed over the window. The street lights glare, hard bits of snow glinting like dust as they fall through the light. But the sidewalk below my building is deserted, the windows across the street rows of dead eyes, dark with curtains and dresses and rugs, like mine are. In Siemisz, light is like a candy poster, and it's not smart to hang signs showing where the sweets are. I let the rug fall back into place and go to the door, pressing an ear to the wood before I turn the lock. The empty hall outside our room stretches to the other empty rooms of the empty apartment. As it should. Everything is as it should be. And then a noise shoots through the silence, louder than a gun, a grenade of fear inside my chest. And I know the sound I have missed. Someone is knocking on my front door. They know. They know. They know. The words beat with my blood. Another mattress spring pops, and I feel Helena coming up behind me. She doesn't speak. She is 6 years old and doesn't have to be told that this is not the time for questions. The knocking comes again, louder, this time with a whisper through the cracks. Stefania? It's a trick. The Gestapo want me to open the door without a fuss, so they don't have to break it down, so they can give a nice, unblemished apartment to some nice German officer and his law-abiding wife with clean hair and mended stockings. Maybe this means they will shoot us outside, like Mr. Schwartzer. The whisper comes again. Open the door! Fuchsia! The Gestapo do not know me by that name. I run for the door, hands out, fingers already searching for the newly repaired lock. I know it isn't him, it can't be him, but I fumble and twist at the lock anyway, then fling open the door. Helena gasps, or maybe the gasp comes from me, because the bare bulb hanging in the hallway has shown me that it's not him. It's not who I thought it would be at all. Max, I whisper.
Sharon Cameron reading from her most recent book, The Light in Dark Places. While researching the story of the two sisters, 16-year-old Stefania and her younger sister Helena, Sharon Cameron had visited what had been their home in Poland during the Second World War. Soon after the Nazis had taken over the town, they had converted a nearby school into a hospital. And then they forced the sisters to give up one of the two tiny bedrooms in their home to two nurses working in the hospital.
And it was very primitive, very damp. no running water. The water, you know, is from the well outside. A very primitive, small place. Really just two rooms and a kitchen, that attic above.
She talked about carrying the buckets out. So there's no bathroom in the house. And you wonder, you know, what do people do about bathing? There's 13 people in the room, you know?
Yes. They didn't do a lot about it. During the time when the Nazis were living directly below them, there was very little opportunity to come out of the attic at all. And it was difficult enough to sneak the drinking water and to sneak the waste bucket, you know, up and down the ladder and keep that taken care of. So no, there was not a lot of bathing. There was not a lot of anything.
Were the two nurses, were they Nazis?
Yes, they were of varying nationalities, but they were with the German army. So they were working in a hospital that had been established directly across the street, a German hospital. And every night, their SS officer boyfriends came and stayed. So every night there were four Nazis directly below. And one of the nurses in particular was very antagonistic to Jews, very anti-Semitic, and made that well known. If she had found them, she would have absolutely 100% turned them in.
How long did this go on?
The situation with the Nazis actually living in the house with them went on about 8.5-9 months. I honestly don't think they could have survived if it had gone much longer. The actual time of their hiding was a little closer to 2 years.
Vanya was working for the Jewish family. She was a housekeeper?
Yes. Well, she was actually working as an assistant in their shop. They had a little grocery store. It sold various things, newspapers and, you know, like a little convenience store. And she came to the city and through a friend of a friend ended up assisting this family in their store, just, you know, as a paid employee, and just became part of the family. They became so close, and Mrs. Diamant, the mother, loved her like a daughter. And at some point, she actually ended up just living with the family in the city when her sisters had moved on and she didn't have a place to stay. They created a spot for her, and she lived with the family as one of the family, which was a very unusual situation for Shemesh Poland. You would not often see Catholics and Jews mix in that way.
Where were Stefania's parents?
Stefania's father had died before the war, so she was with her mother on a farm outside of the city, in a small village called Birtska, and she had 9 brothers and sisters. She was kind of in the middle of all of that. And I think she did not love life on a farm. Two of her sisters had moved to the city, had taken jobs, and she wanted to go with them. And at the age of 12, she convinced her mother to allow her to leave school to go to Shemesh, which was the big city to her. It's really not very big, but to her it was the big city, and work in this grocery store for the Diamant family. That's how she came to be there. And then when her sisters moved, the Diamant family didn't want her to leave, and they took her in. They considered her to be a daughter, and she kept living her life with them up until September of 1939.
The German army occupied the city sometime in the early 1940s?
In 1939.
From 1939?
Yes, September of 1939 is when Germany invaded Poland. Shemesh, the city, was an unusual place in that the river that ran through the middle of the city was actually the demarcation line between Germany and Russia. So one half of the city lived under German rule, and the other half of the city lived under Russian rule. So for the first part of the war, Stefania and the Diamant family lived under Russian rule. They were on the Russian side and lived fairly normally for the time. But then the Germans pushed across the river, took the whole city, and that is when everything changed.
When did that happen?
And that happened in late 1941, coming into 1942. By spring of 1942, all the Jews had been rounded up and put into the ghettos.
So essentially a 3-year time frame then for the girls in terms of the war, German occupation, all the rest of it.
Well, and actually, because they were so close to the line with Russia, Shemesh was one of the early cities liberated by the Russians. So the war actually ended for them in July of 44.
Oh, so this whole thing lasted about 2 years then?
Yes. Very dark, difficult 2 years.
Although, you know, you have to wonder what life was like under the Russians afterwards, if it was that much better. But I guess that's another story. But
well, it is. And Helena, the younger sister, stayed in Poland. She did not immigrate. She still lives there and became a doctor. And she lived under Soviet rule. So, she had a thing or two to say about that. It's not... Well,
can you imagine? You know, I mean, she basically lived her whole life under some kind of foreign power.
Yes.
That's just hard to imagine, you know?
I think it's very difficult to imagine. Especially being American, I think we just have not had to suffer occupation. You know, we have not had to suffer the way so many other people groups in Europe have suffered.
The Nazi went up into the loft.
Yeah.
And a rat appeared out of nowhere, you know, like... At first, I thought she was going to say, and he wondered where the rat came from, you know, but obviously he didn't, you know, he just took it as a given that there was a rat in the attic and that's what made the noise. But I wonder, you know, where those 13 people were while he's up in what must have been a pretty tight little attic, I would think.
Yes, what they had actually done, and it was wonderful, actually, to be able to go up there and stand in that space, you know, to understand what that was like and how it was working. But, you know, it was the cottage that they lived in had someone else on the other side. It was like what we would call a duplex, you know, so there was a front side and a back side. So there was another family living on the other side of the wall of the attic.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't necessarily obvious where the two houses divided. So what they did is they built a false wall across the attic and carved a space behind that false wall. And they were very careful. They used old wood, old nails, you know, nothing that would look new. And they created this false wall so that you could not see what was beyond it. And there was a tiny little door that had been covered up, I think, with junk and, you know, that sort of thing that they put in the attic to just, you know, make it look like a small, you know, tiny attic. So I'm sure that if that SS officer had reasoned anything out, you know, maybe he thought, you know, that it came from the other side. I don't think it was that unusual to have rats. I mean, nobody liked it, but it's the kind of thing that happened, you know. So I think it wasn't, you know, it was just and there were, I mean, it was full of rats up there. You know, it wasn't unusual for them to be there. It was just an incredible stroke of luck or providence that he saw one right then and decided not to investigate any further. And I think it's just one example of when Helena and Stefania really should have been caught and weren't. And, you know, when I was able to read Stefania's unpublished memoir, it was honestly unbelievable how many instances there were where they should have been caught, and they just weren't. And it is, if I had put them all in, honestly, I don't think anyone would have believed the book. Because it's just unbelievable. But that is what happened. And, you know, they just got incredibly lucky again and again. And, of course, the situation with the rats, I was also able to interview one of the children that was hidden in the attic. And so she could tell me, Jusha in the book, and Jusha could tell me, you know, obviously everything about, you know, what it was like to have to sit in that attic. And, you know, the space was so small that 13 people could only fit by lying down on their side. There weren't supposed to be 13 when they built that attic. And the ceiling sloped downward, so there was only space to stand on one end, and then if you weren't very tall. So if one person needed to turn over, they all had to turn. It was that tight up there. So when the Nazis were downstairs and, you know, and in that bedroom directly below the floor, it had to be absolute silence. No one could move. No one could sneeze, snore, cough. Someone had to be awake all the time to keep anyone else from making noise. in their sleep. And when the rats did come, she described to me having to lay there and let the rats run across her skin because she couldn't move. You know, again, I don't think we can have any concept, you know, of what it is like to live under that kind of stress and as a child, or what it's like to triumph over it, which is something that Jisha certainly did and Stefania and Helena did.
If ever there was a story that plays on the imagination, it's this one. There's so many aspects of the story that you say, oh my God, how did that happen? So the young son of the Jewish family who'd been first sent to the ghetto and then, I think, sent to the death camp, is that what happened?
Yes.
So
yes,
he jumped off the train?
Oh, yes. You're talking about Max Diamond.
Yeah.
Yes. And his story is just as amazing as Stefania's. Yes, he was rounded up from the ghetto. He had tried to hide. They had created a hidden space in a cellar trying to hide from this roundup because at that point, it was November of 1942, and they knew exactly where they were going and they knew what was going to happen. They knew the trains were going to Belchik. Belchik was a not a work camp or a slave labor camp. It was just a 100% death camp. It was a death machine. The train loads came in, and they had everyone in the train murdered within 2.5 hours. It was like a factory.
My
it was
God.
Horrible. We met with the historian there, and it was a very profound experience when we visited there in Poland. But that he knew that's where he was headed, and he decided he would rather commit suicide, actually, than leave it to them. And he decided to jump out of the train. And he jumped out of the moving train. They had the other people in the car had to help him by pushing him out because the window was so high. But he jumped off the train and didn't die. And yes, came back to Stefania, who was still living in his parents' apartment, and said, "Can you help me?" He was broken and bloody and injured, and that was the first knock on her door.
How old was he?
By that time, Max was in his early
20s. Oh, okay.
He had been in college studying dentistry, so he was a little bit older. He left one brother behind on that train who did not choose to jump. Of his family, he lost everyone but one other brother, who Stefania also hid. And I was able to actually travel to Poland and have all these adventures and see these places and the attic and Tatarska Street and all of these with Stefania and Max's son, Ed Brzezinski. We went 3 weeks after Stefania had passed away. So it was a very profound experience for both of us to be exploring his mom's life and his dad's life, you know, to the depths that we were at such a very raw time. It was unforgettable.
I imagine it was in some respects a healing process for him.
I think actually it was. And he had not been back to Shemesh. He had been as a young man in his 20s. And, he told me what a different experience it was. We're both very close to the same age. And he said coming back as someone, who was crossing the half-century mark, it was like an incredibly different experience for him to understand his parents as young people and to really think about what their lives have been. He said, in his 20s, he took those stories for granted. He'd been hearing those stories all his life. And, after his mother was gone and his father passed away several years earlier, having them both gone and then going there and just really digging into objectively, I think you're able to step back, as an older adult and look at your parents more objectively. Mm. And being able to do that in that city, I think it really made him think so differently about these stories and realize that he really does feel that he is a steward of his parents' story and that is something that he needs to help preserve and preserve that legacy. But he started a foundation for his mom, the StefiFoundation.org, if anybody wants to check that out. But it's a wonderful thing to help continue his mother's legacy of tolerance and humanity.
You first heard the story, you were quite a bit younger, and you, apparently, if I remember right from what you said on the video, that you weren't a writer at the point where you first heard the story.
No, it was, I heard the story, Stefania tell her own story for the first time I've been trying to figure out the year. I think it was 1992 or 1993, long before I had ever considered being a writer. I was a classical musician before I was a writer, and I had never even considered such a thing, but I just happened to turn my television on in the middle of the week. I believe it was Holocaust Remembrance Week, and our local PBS station here in Nashville, Tennessee, was playing survivor stories from the Holocaust that had been videoed through an oral history project done by the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. And I couldn't continue anything that I was doing. I was riveted. I had to sit there and listen and just take in what this amazing woman had done. And Stefania Pegorska really became my hero that day. I never forgot her story. I didn't forget her story for, you know, more than 20 years. But, you know, you fast forward into the future and suddenly I've become a writer. I have 5 novels and I have things like Google at my disposal. And I thought, you know, I'm going to find Stefania Pegorska. And that is what led me to Ed, her son, who was incredibly kind and open to sharing his family's story with me. And so we went. But the story was so much more than I had realized from what I watched that day. There was so much more. It was so much of a deeper story. I read her unpublished memoir and I realized this is not a story that I want to write anymore because I admire this person so much. This is a story that I think I need to write. I think it's a story that needs to be written. And I don't think I knew that, you know, in 1992, but it struck me so deeply. She had such an inner strength.
I can see why you felt that you should do it. At the same time, I'm thinking, first of all, trying to find someone you could talk to must have been somewhat daunting, even with Google and all the rest of it. And then This is not easy stuff to think about, I wouldn't think.
No, it isn't. It's very dark, I'll say this about it. I'm a history person. I'm certainly not an expert in any area, but history is what I'm interested in. It is what I spend a lot of time thinking about and reading about. And there is almost nothing about the past that is not interesting to me. I'm a very curious person where that's concerned, and I spend a lot of time, you know, trying to understand how we got to where we are and what those patterns are and how they'll continue into the future. It's just part of what I do, and it's a mystery, and I like to solve puzzles as well. So history is my thing. So I knew a lot about World War II. I had read all of Hitler's speeches. I'd read all my grandfather's letters when he was fighting in North Africa during World War II. I have watched unbelievable amounts of documentary, you know, on Poland and Europe and Britain and the Blitz and Doodlebugs, you know, and all of those things. Those are things that I knew a lot about. So when I went to Poland with Ed, I knew a lot of facts. When we went to visit Auschwitz and take the tour like that you do, one of the parts of that tour, you know, obviously it's a very incredibly heavy place to be, but one of the things that they do is they take you in a small group and you walk into the building where they would have them change clothes, you know, take off their clothes, herd them into the next room where they tell them they're going to shower, and they allow you to stand in the gas chamber in silence for 4, maybe 5 minutes. And it is dark, dank, concrete walls that are stained, and frankly it stinks, and I think it will always stink in that room. And I stood in that room and I thought I knew about the Holocaust. I knew nothing about the Holocaust, because you can understand facts and you can understand figures and numbers and all of the things that you can learn. But until you stand in the place and you have one tiny sliver of what all those people actually experienced, until you feel that, I don't think you really know anything. So, you know, after that trip, I did change my perspective quite a bit with the book, because I no longer wanted to write a book that would tell all of these other people about one amazing young woman's experience during the Holocaust and what she did. I didn't want to do that anymore. I wanted to write a book that the reader would feel this one young woman's experience during the Holocaust. Because those facts and figures that, you know, we learn, all of that will fade from our memory. We won't remember all that. But when you feel it, that you're never going to forget. And that's why I think books like this are important. I think it's important that they're historical fiction, because of the way we respond as human beings to story and the way we can connect with the emotions of that person experiencing those things in that story. And I think we have to feel it. We have to feel it so we don't forget it, because this cannot be forgotten.
Well, first of all, Sharon, I commend you for your courage. You're a musician. Musicians, I think, that's what you do. That's how you make music. It's from feeling.
Yes, true.
So,
it's very true.
For somebody who is sensitive as you are, I mean, I can't imagine that it's not pretty traumatic for almost anybody to even just to walk through the gates. I can't even imagine even just walking through the gates of one of those camps, let alone to go into the heart of it, as it were.
I think that what it's important to remember through all of that pain and the death and the horror that was experienced, that there were people like Stefania Pegorska. There were people who made a choice and stood up, and they did something about it. And some of them lost their lives, and we'll never know their stories. But for me, there's an incredible amount of hope in that. Because as dark as the times can be, people do have the choice. They do have the ability to stand up and do something about it. And I think that's why The Light in Hidden Places, to me, is not just a World War II story. You know, because the hatred that caused places like Auschwitz did not die with Hitler. It is out there. It is in many different forms. And, you know, Stefania and Helena Pegorska were two very ordinary girls, a teenage girl and a little girl living in a little town and kind of nowhere Poland. You know, they were not special or extraordinary people in the eyes of the world. But they made a choice, and they stood up, and they chose humanity over hate. And that choice changed everything. It changed the lives of 13 people, and not only them, but their children and their grandchildren. The ripples of that choice changed the world. And I think it's really worth remembering that we who are normal people living normal lives, you know, normal places, that our choices have that exact same potential.
Sharon Cameron is one of the authors who will be reading from her work and talking about it during the Southern Festival of Books, which will be online for 11 days, beginning tomorrow, Thursday, October 1st. Details on the festival are on the website, Southern Festival of Books 2020. This is Scenic Roots.